month. It helps WBAI pay the bills and know how much income we can expect to come in to the radio station. This is listener sponsored WBAI New York. Thank you once again so much.
And you're listening to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. My name is Michael G. Haskins. Good morning, and thank you so very much for tuning in. This is a commercial-free, listener-sponsored community radio station on the air for 60 years, thanks to listeners just like you. 84 degrees right now and cloudy in New York City, going up to a high of 88 degrees today. It's going to be hazy, hot, and humid. But right now at 10 a.m., stay tuned for Talk Out of School.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat.
Good morning, educators, allies, and accomplices, and welcome to Talk Out of Schools. I am Stuart Chen Hayes, professor of school counselor education at CUNY's Lehman College in the Bronx, and guest hosting this week and next for Lainey Hampson. Today's show focuses on rank-and-file activists and educator unions in New York City, fighting for educators, students, parents, and families in the face of austerity budgets, job cuts, class sizes skyrocketing, racism, including the police free schools movement and Black Lives Matter, and COVID-19, too late mid-March closing of schools and unsafe fall reopening. We will discuss the role of rank-and-file in unions, challenging a leadership too close to capitalists and their power structures. For example, National Education Association's Lily Garcia and American Federation of Teachers Randy Weingarten both voted against Medicare for All in the Democratic National Committee 2020 platform when workers overwhelmingly want it. Weingarten backs Biden and Harris when educators overwhelmingly want progressive leaders, not centrists. After a nightly Black Lives Matter protest in New York City, Mayor de Blasio and New York City Speaker Cory Johnson said they'd cut $1 billion from the NYPD budget, and they lied. They kept school security folks in the NYPD and said they'd cut overtime, but it's not binding. And there's no money left in austerity budgets to fix broken ventilation systems, ensure PPE for all upon school return in the fall, or a nurse and a school counselor in every building. The governor and the mayor did not close schools soon enough, and CUNY and K-12 were both caught with tens of staff and faculty killed by COVID-19. Now DOE faces unsafe reopening. Had the K-20 schools closed only 2 weeks earlier, many teachers, paras, and professors' lives would have been saved. The Chicago Teachers Union, or CTU, started things off a decade ago in Chicago when a group of rank-and-file women of color were elected to shift from a business unionism model to bargaining for the common good, centering anti-racism and the needs of Chicago's black and brown working-class students, families, and educators front and center with multiple job actions and strikes to build power and win gains in Chicago. They created what has become known as Red for Ed, spreading to other cities and multiple U.S. UND excesses against K-12 educators, such as privatization, standards-based curricula, test and punish, school closures, poor pay, decreased benefits, and unsafe working conditions. For years in New York City, however, the UFT has not fought for workers, but instead bowed to the wishes of city and state leaders. Dr. Lois Weiner, in her book, The Future of Our Schools, Teacher Unions and Social Justice, shows how conservative the UFT has been over the decades and how it was designed to operate with the needs of white leaders in mind, not the rank and file. More Caucus of UFT was formed to fight back and is calling for a health justice agenda with three demands: anti-racism, fully funded schools with PPE for all, and no unsafe return. More helped organize the National Day of No Safe Return rally this past week in New York City and the Police Free Schools rally this June. In higher education, the City University of New York has been underfunded for decades. This summer, 3,000 CUNY faculty, adjuncts, who are the majority of the PSC teaching force, were fired by CUNY. Rank and File Action, or RAFA, in CUNY formed out of the 7K-er strike movement to shift adjuncts to a living wage, and while not fully successful, helped move PSC CUNY Union to fight for the largest increase in adjunct wages in history. Now, with COVID and anti-racism pandemics, 7K-er strike morphed into RAFA, and RAFA is petitioning for a strike action vote, and PSC CUNY has said all options are on the table this fall. We speak today with Myri, who was a Bronx DOE teacher and organizer with More Caucus, then Aixa Rodriguez, also a Bronx DOE teacher, a leader in Bronx Educators United for Justice, and also an organizer with More, Annie Tan, who is a Brooklyn DOE teacher and native New Yorker, who was in Chicago for several years organizing with CTU, and two CUNY adjunct faculty who organized with RAFA, Jamila Hamami, a doctoral student in social welfare at the grad student and also with the adjunct project, and Reiko Tahara, a documentary filmmaker and adjunct faculty at Hunter College. We begin with Myri. Welcome to and from the Bronx.
Yes, morning.
Hey, it's great to have you with us. So why don't we start with having you tell us about the need for the health justice agenda in More?
Good. So the health justice agenda in More is a vision, a document that places the blueprint, the plan for healing-centered schools, schools that are police-free, schools that embrace social-emotional learning, and it rewards people over profit. So a group of educators were exposed to COVID in COVID-19 in March at the Great Dodge campus, and other educators at several other large campuses around New York City. The impact was so severe in the 3 months section of the Bronx, the Fordham and the Belmont section, with loss of lives of parents, family members, and there was rapid community spread. There were more questions than answers when the press reported what happened to our colleagues. There were gag orders, lack of transparency from the DOE and DOH, as you saw what happened now, the commissioner resigned. So we, the movement of rank and file educators, more reached out to us as social justice advocates. We had group meetings, identified the problems. And we decided that, you know what, we raised concerns to the affected communities, the press, public officials, and electeds. So I'm just going to just summarize here. It's a lot, but your audience needs black and brown patients. We're dying from COVID, still do, twice the rate of whites. Black and brown communities are populations with history of underlying conditions, which make it harder to fight COVID-19. Government policies that creates structural racism causes ongoing health injustice in these black and brown communities, such as the placement of carcinogenic facilities, inequitable closure of hospitals, and limited access to health and medical professionals. So we realized that this was institutional, it was systemic. There was cultural racism, which also impacted black communities most, but also, and just listen to me carefully, we also recognized as a group that there was a spike in anti-Asian incidents and xenophobia in general. So we do understand that decades of austerity cuts, by Democratic governors, and we have here austerity Andy Cuomo in office, who is already starving us of the monies we need. So we decided that the health justice agenda, we had discussions, we had Zoom meetings, surveys, petitions, we had coalition building, community input, and research. Most importantly, research, as you know, Dr. Chen Hayes, you are one of those leaders in the field. And the movement of rank and file created this document to offer our non-negotiable demands for how the DOE, the Department of Education in New York City, must protect our health. And whenever it chooses to reopen schools and to offer a progressive vision of how schools can realign. So first, we want to make sure that the well-being of our students, the families, and communities were held high above high-stakes testing, conformity, and discipline in our schools. So in one phrase, it sums up to healing center schools. And this is a concept we incorporated from our allies in the Bronx called a healing center schools working group. And that would be our ultimate goal. So in saying this, the health justice agenda was the first document in the United States, which had a vision of what safe schools look like. Politicians reviewed the document, such as public advocate Jermaine Williams was on Press with us last week when he rolled out his phased reopening plan, which aligned with our social justice, non-criminalizing police-free schools with an anti-racist lens. Much has happened since then, Dr. Chen Hayes, and our allied stakeholders have escalated now as the DOE is not listening. They're saying they're going full remote. So we have public health concerns about reopening schools, about a second wave of COVID, which will again impact Black and brown communities more than any other communities. And I want to give a shout out to one such group, which is a parent advocate group called Back to School Safely New York. And we're calling on the governor right now and the DOE to prioritize safety, equity, and compassion before schools open.
Thank you, Myrie. I always say the Bronx deserves the best, and with you, we certainly have that. Way awesome. All right, so we've seen 400 years of structural racism in the United States, and that has targeted all peoples of color, but particularly people of African descent. What is it like right now for U of T members, families, and especially our students who are Black males right now in New York City, and how can more demands help?
Good. So I will start with a preface here that says the union needs to change its stance, the UFT, United Federation of Teachers. They really need to say Black Lives Matter and really mean it. I see Randy Weingarten is dancing with the stars in Washington. I don't know if she has aspirations to become the Secretary of Education, but she has said it to some extent. But we need to know that these leaders of her unions, they really mean it. I know Lily. I trust her. I never met her in person, but it's a person who has done the work. You see, she has the NEA, Ed Justice. She has the Black Lives Matter posted on her website. She has the working groups that's doing this work. Where is the UFT on this? Silence. Where is the AFT on this? Silence. So UFT members are concerned, to answer your question. We're fearful, especially the Black and brown educators, because, you know, we are susceptible to this disease. We're anxious. We want to teach our students. We want to service our students, but as safe as possible. Many of us are worried that lives were lost to COVID, and many members that were lost were people of color. A large amount of paraprofessionals, for those who are listening, are another name for them is teachers' assistants. They also lost their lives. We teachers, Black and brown teachers, we have concerns about teaching in person, bringing the virus home to adult parents in our homes and our families. Many educators are also worried about accommodations, which is the DOE gives you some form of relief to stay home based on if you meet certain criteria, CDC. So if you have pre-existing conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, asthma, obesity, and many are concerned because they applied and have not heard back as yet. All right, so in addition to that, many families in urban settings are worried. They live in apartments. They have intergenerational families. And COVID spread is likely in areas of high density. Listen to the signs, folks. So families are also worried about the limited information that is coming out from the DOE. So they text teachers all the time. They call teachers. They ask for information. And that's what we do as a caucus. We supply the information. If we don't have it, we'll get it. So many families who work in the private sector now have to decide between going to work and sending their children to school in person. So they didn't have the information that NYSED gives them a break if they have somebody in the house who's pregnant or have these conditions. God, this information was not given to them in the survey. So more, what has more done? We have joined local and national groups. We have sister caucuses around the country, as you mentioned before, Chicago, UTLA, Baltimore, and we have national groups, National Ed Justice, and all those groups. We're called for the canceling of rents, calling to create health care for all, regardless of immigration status, calling to expand financial support for families in need and provide accommodations for workers who need to do child care. We have educators who are doing it. We have administrators as well, and for whom in-person work poses higher risks for them in your households.
Wow. Amazing, Myrie. I so appreciate your fierce advocacy and activism. Anything else you'd like to add? We have about a minute before our next speaker.
Yes. Returning to school for me is traumatic because COVID hit me real hard. I lost immediate members of my family, so I know what social distance funerals are like. I also know what it is like not to honor a loved one's will. Many families have lost loved ones in almost every school. Somebody knows somebody was lost their life. The caucus has made it absolutely clear that the COVID crisis has laid bare the extent of inequality and racism in our society. We have been fighting it all along. What it has highlighted and exacerbated is the extreme greed and disregard for people in power that have for the health and wealth, well-being of low-income people. As we look toward the end of the COVID-19 crisis, we do not need to seek return to business as usual. Business as usual is what got us here. We imagine a society where true equity becomes the new normal. We settle for nothing less. So just saying here for 20 seconds, I appreciate the D15 administrators in Brooklyn who crafted a letter to Cuomo and Carranza saying they want to go full remote learning. It's not going to work. And I want to say to the DOE, Mayor de Blasio, the governor, and all you politicians that are out there, and the Educators Union, you Mulgrew, President, and Mark Arnazzo of the CSA, custodial unions, you're not at the table. DC-37, where are you? We must ask for a voice. And this cannot be done if we are not talking to educators, parents, and students. Who's talking to the over 120,000 homeless students, asking their families for input? Where will they be schooled? Making arrangements for them to attend schools in proximity of shelters. And who's talking about our youth in adult ed? Who's talking about the social-emotional needs of our students? I'll end here. Thanks for the audience for listening.
Myrie, that was amazing. Thank you. And breaking news out of New Jersey, as we speak, Governor Murphy is now allowing any educators who want to go remote. So let's hope that New York City and state are listening. Okay, that was amazing from Myrie. We continue in the Bronx with our next guest, who is Aixa Rodriguez. Aixa, tell us more about the most recent action in the city that Moore did with National No Unsafe Return to Schools, and especially what you did as part of it for Moore. Give our listeners the visuals.
A visual of the rally?
Yes. What were you doing during the rally?
I was dressed as a skeleton. I had a skeleton mask. I had a shirt. I had little gloves. I backed up my friend, Sarah Shafi, who's a brilliant idea to try to dramatize what was really happening to us with being the march to our harm and our death. We wanted to show what it would look like. So we were carrying coffins in the street, body bags in the street. You know, people were wearing things to get attention and to dramatize things, because the reality is that people keep pushing us to unsafe circumstances, not answering questions and engaging in what we call hygiene theater, telling us that all of these things will be cleaned, magically cleaned. They're going to give some Ghostbuster pack to the custodians. He's magically going to electro spray the whole school and everybody will be safe. And we know this is not the truth. We know this, having not what happened in Grace Dodge, what happened in different schools around every borough, the different outbreaks, the little clusters, and the absolute denial of the Department of Education and the Department of Health of their absolute failure to communicate. So we knew that people were infected and were spreading it in the schools. And because the DOH and the DOE weren't communicating, the diagnosis from different hospitals were denied, and they didn't shut down schools. They claimed that those were self-reported diagnoses from Montefiore Hospital, was a self-reported diagnosis. So they don't want to listen to teachers. So we wanted to make them listen to us by being as loud and bold as we could be.
Mm-hmm. So there was also a guillotine in the
Tamara built this wonderful guillotine, and she put DOE and us, and people took pictures with our heads in the middle, because we do really feel threatened that it is our careers and our livelihood or our lives. So that needed to be dramatized, and we marched all the way from the front of our union. We had a band. We had drummers. And the original concept was this idea of the New Orleans funeral. And it started to, act, you know, it started to grow with different people. And we had lots of speakers. We had parents. We had students. We had, you know, just regular people from schools, OTs, PTs. We had nurses. We had pediatricians. We had professors. We had a wide variety of our allies show up with us because they understand exactly what was happening, to dramatize us, to speak to the issue.
And the streets are full of black and brown folks.
Well, yeah. And who was suffering the most, right? What was the situation? The inequities that already existed just were, you know, were the worst situation once COVID hit.
So
we knew exactly what was happening.
I think this is really important because you're showing the creativity and the joy and the rage of More Caucus members and how you take that to the streets and how you really show that this is a very different type of leadership than what we've seen at the top of educator unions in the past, particularly in UFT in New York City. So talk to us some about what it was like. You had alluded earlier to that we had faculty and staff who died at Grace Dodge and at Brooklyn Tech. What was going on for educators and students and so many folks in the midst of COVID-19 when the DOE and the state refused to close early in March? And how has More pushed back?
So we were more response to our members. People contact us when things happen. So what More did is we went into action. We tried to help coordinate, get people to talk to each other, connect to each other. And eventually we amassed a lot of energy from lots of people who were hearing similar things, where self-reported was the label for a diagnosis that was given in a hospital. And people were not being treated properly and information was being withheld. Schools were not shut down. No cleaning happened. All the protocol that was in that memo from the state was not followed. And there was lots of, you know, pushing off the responsibility to others. They did not want to close the schools. So the teachers had to call out sick and do a sick out. We definitely organized ourselves. Hey, we're not coming. So you're going to have to get, you know, 23,000 substitutes. How about that? So, you know, we get the energy from our members. The rank and file have to give us that energy and creativity. And we act on this because we don't come up with it on our own. These people contacted us because of what they were going through. More is known to be listening and to respond.
And in addition to teaching and school counseling and doing all the work in schools, you all were 24/7 on social media, fighting politicians, fighting the chancellor, nonstop trying to get schools closed.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, trying to inform parents, trying to connect people to resources. It's a lot of things that our union should be doing. And instead, they are sitting on their hands and wondering what to do, threatening lawsuits and not using, in the worst pandemic in history so far, not using the union power. They have all our dues. And what are they doing with them?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you are Puerto Rican, and I am curious if you can talk about what it's like for you and Bronx families, other Puerto Rican and Latinx families facing so much illness and loss and unemployment and unsafe return to school and systemic racism for hundreds of years. How does that feel, and how is More fighting back?
That's a thesis right there. I'll tell you, as an ESL teacher, all of my students are immigrants. They all live in different pockets and neighborhoods. Had I been in school, had we not shut the school down, I could have been a vector that would have infected kids from the African community, Bangladeshi community, Dominican community, Mexican community, and all five boroughs, because my school is a Manhattan school that accepts all kids. So understand that when teachers go in and they're sick, they can pass it off to their kids, and their kids live all over New York because we have this high school lottery. So it would have been a very serious situation. Why? Because I lost my grandmother to COVID. My grandmother had got COVID. Because, like me, she was very, I got it from her, a very independent woman. And even at her age of 82, wanted to go to the bodega, wanted to play her little lotto, wanted to have her cookies and her cake. And we love her, but she went out and we were telling her not to go out. And, you know, she got sick. I mean, the frustration that we had was trying to help and give her gloves, do all her groceries, and try to take care of her, but she still got it. And she was a two-time cancer survivor, a diabetic, And she was very weak immune system, and it was horrible. And she passed away in one of the most shameful, horrible ways. We couldn't be with her. It was devastating emotionally. We couldn't have a wake. We couldn't have anything proper. My mother, because she was helping care for her, was exposed. We didn't really know that she was sick. My mother started to have low oxygen. She didn't have the same symptoms as my grandmother, but we went to Puerto Rico to bury my grandmother. And we couldn't have an open casket. We couldn't have a wake. We couldn't have any of the things we normally would have culturally. The family couldn't gather. There was a lot of pain. It felt like a rush. We flew to Puerto Rico. The body was delayed. It was a frustrating situation. And my mother got sick, and she was getting worse and worse. We went to the hospital, COVID. She was in the hospital in Puerto Rico. We had already been quarantined in New York, by the way. In Puerto Rico, hospitalized for 5 days, right? I had no symptoms, nothing. When sleeping in the air conditioner, I got sick. I got like bronchitis. When we went with my mother, they tried to force me at the hospital to take the test. And I was like, I need to bury my grandmother now. And I can't be not outside. I need to put her to rest. This was an emotional toll, like ridiculous. It would have been three generations sick, three of us, three generations sick. And we lost my grandmother. My mother and I are both diabetic as well, so we were vulnerable. Come to find out, after taking two negative tests in Puerto Rico, came back to New York, I had antibodies all along. So God knows when I had it, when I was exposed to it or whatever. Thank God we shut down the schools. Because all along, even though I was asymptomatic and, you know, nothing was there, I had it. The reality is that there are people in worse circumstances than I had. Multiple family members passed away. The amount of money that it would take to bury people, not being able to have the wake, the actual mental toll that it takes on people. And then you add the issue of rent being due and the moratorium ending. So we really need to cancel rent for people. If we need to come up with a program where you pay the landlord directly, then do that. We need to cancel rent because we also have a food insecurity issue. We had lots of local food banks run out. People were desperate to try to stop their stuff. And, you know, people were too slow on getting SNAP recipients' money directly to their card, too slow in responding. Now all of the ideas that parents like Tanisha Grant had about giving money directly to people who are already suffering so they could quarantine, so they can stay home because they didn't have the food, they didn't have the money. And getting it directly to them, they finally coming up with these ideas and slowly trickling, giving the money towards kids on a SNAP card, for them to be able to have food that they would have had in the school, trying to address this food insecurity. But people need to move faster. And if you look at the maps and the percentages of infection in different neighborhoods, we are not at a 1%, 2% in each neighborhood. So the reality is everyone is having a different experience.
And with that, Aixa, I hate to say it, we need to move fast, but I want to share how sad and enraged I am for your family, the loss of your grandmother. And I appreciate that how you channel your fury and rage is through Bronx Educators United for Justice and for the Moore Caucus and Fighting Back. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Okay, we had a bit of a musical interlude from Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall, as we shift to our next speaker. Thank you again to Ayesha Rodriguez. And now we speak with Sunset Park teacher Annie Tan. Annie, welcome.
Hello. It's so great to be here today.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice. You grew up in Chinatown. You now teach in Sunset Park. And recently, you were part of the Chicago Teachers Union in Chicago. What did you learn about organizing rank-and-file folks in Chicago with CTU that you've now brought back to New York City?
So I think, first of all, I moved to Chicago in 2011 when there was a hiring freeze here in New York City after the recession. And now there's another hiring freeze happening here in New York, which is going to be preventing a whole new generation of teachers coming into this school district. So we also have to remember that alongside all these budget cuts, that there aren't teachers coming into the system. And, you know, when I went to Chicago, I was like, okay, I just need a job. You know, that was the primary goal for me. But what I learned from the Chicago Teachers Union was, no, I actually have to ground my students. I think a lot of us teachers come in with this, like, savior mindset that we're going to save our students, and that's just not the case. We can't be leading as teachers and instructors thinking we have all the answers because we don't. Clearly, we don't with this pandemic. And leading with students, especially as Chicago is a majority student of color district, as is New York City, we really have to think about what is equitable, what is just, what does segregation look like, and how does that affect our school systems. And so the Chicago Teachers Union led with all those things and said that our students' learning conditions are our teachers' working conditions, and really tie that together so that when they struck the next year that I was there in 2012, there were tens of thousands of people in the streets. Parents, students, organizers, community advocates, and they all stood together and said, we want the schools that our students deserve. And that led me to just think, wow, like, what would a system look like if it were rank and file led, if it were led by teachers and students and families? And it just, after coming back here, I've taught here in New York City for 4 years, I still wonder that today, like, what would it look like here in New York if the teachers and the students were the ones dictating education policy rather than government people who know nothing about education?
Oh, teach my sister, teach on more levels than one. That is the goal. All right. You've written extensively. You and I are both writers, most recently in the New Republic, mm-hmm. about what it's like to be a teacher in New York City right now and an unwillingness to return unless it's safe. And we've just learned that Governor Murphy in New Jersey has given permission for all districts to go remote as of this morning. So with that news in mind, share with listeners what it's like to be rank and file unionist teaching in Sunset Park right now with one of the highest COVID-19 infection rates in the city.
So in March and April, you know, everything that Ayesha said earlier, that it's not just us that's being affected, it's our students too. So I had 12 students this past spring with three paraprofessionals and myself, and among all of us, we had 14 family and friends die of COVID-19 or other things during this pandemic, and the toll hit my students and it hit my staff, and we don't know where it came from, but I do know there were educators that were positive all through the district, and you know, we were forced to come in those 3 days after schools were closed, March 17th, 18th, and 19th. And who knows whether that could have spread COVID-19. As Ayesha said earlier, you know, the mayor and the chancellor and New York City Public Schools had blood on his hands. And when I was trying to teach remotely in the spring, you know, I'd have students who were completely unfocused and, you know, couldn't listen to me either over the phone, through text or email or video chat. And they would tell me that they missed a relative or that they were going to a hospital because they were dealing with COVID-19. I'm not doing that again for my students. I'm not letting them go through that situation. And I'm also not letting them go through a situation where they feel like they may have infected someone else or maybe even killed someone. You know, Aisha said, like, maybe she spread it. We don't know. Like, I don't want kids to lead a whole life thinking that they may have infected someone, but that also their school district allowed that choice to be made without them in mind. Right now, like, we all need to be fighting like hell and saying, no, like, we will not put families or students in positions where they have to make the really hard choices of possibly spreading this virus either in school or in their communities at home. And yes, there is a need. I'm a special education teacher. There is a need for therapies, right, for students who, you know, maybe nonverbal or have functional needs. There are ways to do this that don't require all 1.1 million students to come into schools while also not forcing all educators into the school system either. And no one in the DOE is thinking of those creative options. They're steamrolling ahead without us teachers in mind, and it is going to kill people.
All right. Well, on that note, but that's,
I know, it's real dark. I'm sorry.
Fighting for our lives. No.
Yes.
You're a family member of the late Vincent Chin, who was murdered in Detroit decades ago in an act of hate. You're writing a book about your family now, and that and many other experiences. Let's leave with a last question of how have the twin pandemics of COVID and racism affected you and folks in Asian and Pacific Islander communities in New York City and nationally?
I'll just say quickly, you know, we're not free until everyone's free, right? Asian Americans are included in that, that there's a lot of invisibility around what we go through. The Black Lives Matter movement is trying to raise that for Black and Indigenous people of color. And we really need to still focus on having educators of color, having ethnic studies curriculums, having more counselors, school counselors, as you say so much on Twitter, Stuart. And we really need to focus on people learning their history so we can unlearn everything that, you know, this society taught us about what it means to be a savior or what it means to be individual, because collectivism would have saved us from this pandemic as it has in many other countries. But we refuse to be part of a collective, and that's why 160,000 people or 1 in 2,000 Americans has died of COVID-19.
Painfully and beautifully said. Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Oh, my pleasure. We now are going to move to speak. We'll be right back in just a moment with Jamila Hamami.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
All right, and we are back with speaker number four today, the fabulous Jamila Hamami. Jamila, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me, sir.
Oh, you got it. Anytime. You teach community organizing classes in CUNY. What led you to involvement with the CUNY Adjunct Project, Seven Cares Strike, and now Rank and File Action?
Yeah, so I actually started out as a youth organizer many, many years ago. In Texas, around the war in Iraq. That's how I became activated in 2003. I'm actually Arab American. And so it was a really big deal for me in high school. And then as time progressed on, I had done different organizing but had gotten into academia through teaching while I was actually an executive director of an organization I had founded called the Queer Detainee Empowerment Project. And after I saw the conditions of what we were experiencing in terms of pay, I was coming in right as the new contract was kind of being formed and everyone was in discussion about that. And I was pretty enraged that I was only going to be paid, I think it was around $3,000 or something like that, for a 3-credit course. And I also, my course always ends up being about 50 students. I have one of those courses that's the only course that exists at Hunter, and I don't have the option to have it split as many times as I've asked. They don't have it in the budget. So with all of those things, I just realized that we needed to be in a better position and we needed to have more power, and that the two-tier system wasn't working in academia and that we really needed to fight at a CUNY. And so that was how I kind of got bolstered into organizing at CUNY and being a part of Seven Care Strike. And also, this is the first union I've ever had the opportunity to be a part of, so I was really excited to be a part of it. However, I will say that I'm not as happy with what the union has done for us up until this point. But that's why rank and file action exists, right? So mm-hmm. I'm happy to be here doing work with RAFA and with the adjunct graduates.
Well, we're thrilled to have you in the union. It's great that this is your first experience. You also are quite creative. You have designed the RAFA website. You did the meme for today's show. So big shout out and appreciation to your creativity. What has led RAFA to sponsor the Strike Action Pledge, which is on the rankandfileaction.com website? And how can faculty and allies and students sign on to the movement?
The reason why we decided to do the strike authorization is because we are fed up. There are thousands and thousands of people that have been laid off at CUNY because of austerity. But I want to be really clear when I talk about austerity, right? Because I think that their belief system that this is COVID-caused austerity, this was already a problem. This is just an additional problem. So we're angry that our colleagues are being fired. I got really lucky and I managed to not get laid off. I was sure that I was going to be, which would have complete, I was going to drop out of PhD school because of it, because I need healthcare so badly. Yeah, well, I need healthcare really badly. I actually am somebody with an autoimmune disorder, so I need to have healthcare. So we were just angry about people losing their jobs, losing healthcare. How are people going to take care of their kids? Also, are you really going to have us return to work? Like, there are all of these facets to go into the necessity of us striking to ensure everyone's safety and ensure everyone receives pay, right, for their labor, and that people aren't just being laid off because the city decided to not fund the budget for education. And if the community wants to get involved, there's actually a petition for the community as well. All of it's on our website, which is rankandfileaction.com.
Excellent. All right. As a queer Tunisian Muslim, how have queer and trans persons and North Africans, Arabs, and Arab Muslims been affected by the twin pandemics of COVID-19 and racism in CUNY and New York City? And how is RAFA fighting back?
All right, that's a loaded question. So in terms of what RAFA is doing to fight back, RAFA actually has a really wonderful working group that's working on decolonizing ourselves as an organization, as a group in CUNY, right, and also fighting racism and being explicitly anti-racist. And I'm really proud of that. I think that's an important thing that a lot of people talk about but don't actually follow through on. In terms of how things have been going and faring in, I would say, let's just go ahead and say the Muslim community first, the Arab Muslim community. And this is just, I can't speak to Black Muslims. I can only speak to Arab Muslims and my experience with them. Essentially, you know, all the mosques shut down. We didn't, like, everyone, to be honest, like, for once, I think that, like, our common, you know, belief systems and things that we do on a regular basis were kind of vindicated in some ways, right? So like our ritual practices, like Mudu, for example, which is like the frequent hand washing that we do, right? Or like the greeting without shaking hands. Like those things are things that we already weren't doing. So it's all good, in my opinion. And I think that that's been great. And we've fared well. I mean, you can compare it to some of the other faiths that are really strong in New York City and how they continue to choose to go to practice their faith together. That's not what we've been doing. And I think also it's important to point out that Ramadan was during Ramadan was during this time, and Eid was during this time, excuse me. And giving has really shifted. Like, typically, it's usually, I know for me, for example, I always give to Palestine every year. And I did give to Palestine this year, but then I also gave to local Muslims that I knew that had lost work because they were cab drivers, and they lost work because of it, right, because of the pandemic. So I think that that's something that people are doing, too, is that people have been giving more locally rather than internationally. And I think that, you know, it's also, I've heard from women that wear hijab that they also feel a little bit safer now, which I think is a really wonderful thing. And I'm not saying that this situation has not come with its negativities. That's not it at all. I'm just about to drop a really big negative bomb. So I want to really uplift the positive things that have happened in the Muslim community around the pandemic. In terms of the queer community, though, I mean, we've had our struggles. I'm sure people have seen the notification that came out from the Department of Health about safer sex practices, what to do, what not to do, how people are contracting it. I won't go into details about what it is, what it says. I don't know if that's radio friendly, so go and look at it. But there are some really great details on there for anyone that is engaging in any sexual practices during this time. But I know that it actually has been a problem in the queer community, keeping people separate, engaging in safer sex practices that are kind of next level because of the pandemic, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Safer sex takes on a very different flavor, as it were, in the midst of COVID in terms of how the disease is transmitted.
So very on much
that, so. Right. On that note, I really want to thank you for being all of whom you are and doing all this amazing creative and fight that work with Rafa. All right. Thank you. Our final
thank
speaker.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you got it. Momentarily will be with us. We are making history on Talk Out of Schools with five speakers today. Last but not least, we have Reiko Tahara with us. And Reiko, go for it. It's great to have you here.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
You got it. So what led to your involvement with Rank and File Action in PC CUNY? And why should all CUNY faculty and staff and students get involved?
Sure. So, yeah, I've been teaching as an adjunct in universities for the past 13 years. And, you know, for the first, the past 7 or 8 years, I somehow convinced myself that, you know, because I only teach one class at the CUNY, that I, you know, I'm better than others, maybe. And I'm like, you know, I'm making living as a translator elsewhere. So, you know, I wasn't really active for a long time. But since 2016, I got involved in 7-Kill Strike first and then Rafa now, because I participated in the union's negotiation effort and experienced their victory. But when, you know, when we saw the contract, we figured out that although we participated in the strike authorization that they did and 92% voted yes, that we didn't really get so much benefit out of it. And so this was a disillusioning experience. And then I started going to the 7-Kill Strike meeting, and then I learned a lot since then. And, you know, and so the reason why we have to be involved is that because essentially I learned through the Rafa experience that the reason of the austerity budget is because essentially, in my opinion, CUNY is for working class students of color. And that's where the austerity budget originates. And, you know, that's why the struggle of the adjuncts, and you know, in the meantime, it's the CUNY is privatizing. So in a way. So, you know, the, for example, at Hunter College where I teach, 72% of the teaching force is adjunct. And so we really have to like work together with students because cause is the same. And we have to really, you know, fight the racism in the United States and in New York City to make sure that CUNY exists for all working class people.
Beautifully and powerfully said. What, going right along with that, what has your experience been as an immigrant from Japan? You are a documentary filmmaker and as a Hunter adjunct. And how is RAFA challenging racism, xenophobia, and immigrant bias, both in CUNY and New York City?
Sure. So so after 2016, it's been a very good opportunity for me to reflect on my own experience as an immigrant too, because I thought I'm like, you know, I thought I need to recognize my privilege, but at the same time, it made me a chance to reflect on my own disprivilege, because, you know, like in the beginning, I tried to make a living as an adjunct and I was teaching in like three different universities in Philadelphia and in New York while I was working at the sushi restaurant, like chain sushi restaurant kitchen, and washing dishes with, you know, fellow immigrants from Bangladesh. And, you know, the owner was Canadian and management was Japanese and it was very layered. And inside of my department also, I've experienced enough, you know, from other, from full-time faculty, not the nicest treatments, or like I've seen a lot of my students who are students of color experience really hard things in my department. So gradually I learned, and also, you know, as an immigrant parent, I have a 22 years old and, you know, going through all K to 12 in New York City public school. So it was a really learning experience my whole life here. That, you know, like, and coming out from a very anti-immigrant country, Japan, and living here as an immigrant for 30 years, I, you know, that gave me a lot of perspective and it's a humbling experience for me. So it's a constant negotiation, like, you know, how privileged I am and how I'm not. And, you know, we were chased out of the Park Slope Prospect area that we lived 28 years to now lovely, you know, brown and black neighborhood of Ocean Hill. And I'm loving this community. At the same time, I'm learning a lot new things. And so, yeah, it's a constant, you know, reminder and also negotiation. And so through that, you know, the RAFA, you know, had five demands in April, like in this COVID, you know, there are five demands in April was no unsafe work and no layoff of non-reappointment, low enrollment minimums and course caps and time worked equal time paid and restore in-person teaching as soon as it's safe. And we also endorsed Free CUNY, which is a really amazing, mostly, you know, BIPOC and frontline students in CUNY, their demands of tax the rich to heal New York and provide distance learning resources for all students, teachers, and staff, and free food, healthcare, and housing to all CUNY students and, you know, everybody in CUNY, and free childcare and full refund for spring 2020. And so we work with students and we work with other, now with other workers in CUNY, not only PSC, but the DC-37 workers. And so I think it's really important. I'm sorry. And in light of Black Lives Matter, I mean, you know, many waves of Black Lives Matter, but especially in June, it bursted. So, you know, in my department, on department, students rose up and, you know, demanded, you know, decolonizing the curriculum in my department. And I've been hearing a lot similar things are happening elsewhere, you know, throughout CUNY, in Brooklyn College or Brooklyn, I mean, CUNY Law School and, you know, studio art programs or art history department. They are all like demanding to decolonize the curriculum. So, in response to that, RAFA is also standing up to, you know, kicking cops out of CUNY. And also, like, when the F1 visa, you know, incident happened, RAFA stood up quickly. And so I think, you know, we had a demand in April, but which is shifting. And it's really important now to include anti-racism or anti-oppression or decolonizing the, you know, decolonizing the place we live in RAFA's demand. And we are working on it. So, you know, it's really, I'm really happy that my life as an immigrant and my activity in at Hunter and in RAFA are kind of merging together. And, you know, I feel like every day, like I'm living my, you know, living and practicing in my life, kind of. So it's a very powerful moment, I feel. Mm-hmm. And another good thing about the Rafa, I'm sorry, can I continue?
I'll go for sure.
Yep.
Sure.
Okay, so and another great thing about Rafa is that it's an it's a very action oriented group, and it's been wonderful to know other adjuncts from other adjuncts and full timers and admin people and staff from other CUNY schools, and because before that I was very just isolated adjunct in my own little department. And now I'm very empowered by working with everybody in CUNY, especially other adjuncts from other CUNY schools. And we are action oriented. So we've been doing phone bankings and letter writing campaigns and, teach-ins and grade-ins and all sorts of things that PSC union leadership, failing to do. So we are trying to supplement their work at the same time expanding ourselves to include other union members within CUNY.
Mm-hmm. Wow. There is so much to unpack in terms of what you shared. It's great. It's really profound that you left one virulently anti-immigrant country and landed in another. So that's one takeaway for me. The other piece is breaking the isolation for adjuncts becoming a part of Rafa. I know that's happened in Moore as well. So many teachers, K-12, feel very isolated in their classrooms, and that's very similar in terms of PC CUNY as well. And so this fighting force has come about in Rafa and has really built solidarity because people have gotten to know each other and people really see that the issues are so similar across the 22 campuses in CUNY. So I really appreciate you bringing that all together. All right, Reiko, anything else you'd like to add before we finish up?
I feel that, it's a fun place to be. I mean, I'm learning a lot, so I hope, if CUNY workers that work, listening in today, just, go to the rank and file action, is it .com? Find rank and file action and join in because there's a lot to do now. So,
yep, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Stuart.
You got it. All right. Well, time to wrap up. Thanks to all of our amazing rank and filers today, inspiring fighters for equity, justice, anti-racism, no more austerity budgets for hiring CUNY faculty, course caps, and no unsafe return for students or educators in New York City. We have on the WBAI Talk Out of Schools page a list of internet resources and the websites for Jamila, Reiko, and Annie, Moore, and Rafa. You can see a wealth of internet resources on morecaucus.com and rankandfileaction.com, our websites. And don't forget to donate to this show and listener-supported WBAI with a one-time donation or monthly donation as a BAA buddy. Stay tuned for next week's show, and I will interview four school and college counselors on the state of school and college counseling responding to the twin pandemics of COVID-19 and racism. My guests will be Mercy College Professor of School Counseling Cynthia Wally, former New York City School Counselor and Professor of School Counseling at Manhattan College Ian Levy, Washington, D.C.-based anti-racism author and school counselor Alicia Oglesby, and Degrees NYC Director and Goddard Riverside College Counselor Judith Lorimer. Stay strong and be fabulous, New York City. We will see you next week.
Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old.